In Cassian's texts on vainglory, taken from the Institutes, book 11 of his Institutes, one finds a kind of repetition of what one has found in Evagrius, although there are some rather pleasant little stories that augment and clarify some aspects of this. They kind of provide little pegs in our mind by which we can remember his insights. But on the other hand, when it has to be said that Cassian's definitions are often not as precise. In fact, one doesn't quite get a sense of exactly what he understands vainglory to be. He isn't as willing to define it as seeking glory from others as one finds in Evagrius. And so it remains a little nebulous, and sometimes it's not altogether certain how he intends this to be distinguished from pride. But as we'll see, he does make it clear, in particular, in chapter 1, that this is the most changeable and subtle, the most varying and therefore deceptive of the vices, literally because it can use any success against one. In chapter 2, he points out that our successes both in overcoming physical difficulties, that is to say, tendencies towards eating too much or towards sexual excess, our success in the area of gluttony, our discovery of temperance, our ability to lead a chaste life, these can become sources of vainglory, but so can our spiritual selves. The ability to deeply understand spiritual mysteries, the ability to be a very great contemplative, these things can also be sources of a kind of spiritual arrogance. And so vainglory has the ability to take our successes, whether of a carnal or a spiritual nature, and transform them into failures, into vices. So that is something that he points out, particularly in chapter 2. If we drop down again to chapter 3, he emphasizes again all the different ways and forms and shapes vainglory can take, and makes the point again and highlights it and develops it a bit more in chapter 4. In chapter 5, he says that therefore vainglory is kind of like an onion. You just think you've stripped off one aspect of it and you discover another. It has the ability to make use of whatever the soul presents it with, in order to cause the soul to imagine too many good things about itself. However, again, in chapter 6, he points out that vainglory is not altogether dealt with by solitude. That is, going off into the hermitage is not a solution for the sin of vainglory. It's possible to take inordinate pleasure in one's spiritual successes, in one's virtues, even when one is not present to community. And this suggests that Cassian, too, has the sense that the primary focus, the primary place in which one experiences vainglory is in community. It's wanting the other to be the one who reflects back to me how glorious and holy I am. But here he's pointing out in chapter 6, retiring into the hermitage does not necessarily solve the problem. I can still take an inordinate pleasure in my virtues, even if I'm living alone, even if I'm living in solitude. Then in chapter 7, he points out the resilient nature of this vice. Just when you think you've dealt with the problem, suddenly it jumps up again. And he goes on to say that it doesn't go away either, as he's already said, by living in the desert, by going into solitude, or by advancing years. This is a point that Evagrius makes, particularly, I think, as we saw in the area of anger, that the vice of anger, the temptation of misguided thumos, will remain until the moment of death. It's not something that is ever really settled. It can constantly be reawakened in the soul. Cassian is now making the same point about vainglory. There are parts of the struggle that will remain with us throughout life, and so one cannot imagine that we will ever completely finish with the practice, with the ascetical life. One will always need to be depending on God for the grace to continue making spiritual progress. If we drop down to chapter 9, he repeats the notion of the danger of vainglory because it is mixed with, associated with virtues, with very positive things. And in chapter 10, he gives an Old Testament example along with chapter 11 as well. And one can look at those if you wish. He tries to root an understanding of this vice, of this temptation, in biblical precedent. And he also provides in chapter 12 the biblical contradictions, the antiresis that one can use, the reminder of the fact that we are advised against this, particularly by St. Paul, but also by the Lord himself in the context of St. John's Gospel. He talks in chapter 13 about particular ways, about particular aspects of monastic life that can especially serve as the occasions for vainglory, and in chapter 14, again, along with Evagrius, he points out that one of the temptations that this will take is a sense that one is necessarily called to orders. I should undertake preaching and teaching because I am such a marvelously spiritually advanced person, and that is just a reminder, a demonstration of the fact that I need to do a lot more spiritual work. That is not a decision I make on my own. It's not a decision I make simply because I experience myself as somehow reflected back in the light of others as being a really glorious person. He describes in chapter 15 that vainglory is a kind of inebriation. And here again, when one could use the model that we saw in Evagrius, a kind of illusion or delusion. It's a falsehood, it's a false interpretation, an incorrect and, if you will, inappropriate assessment of things that are real. It's a failure to acknowledge or to see the real truth about the skills that we may well have, the desire to, or the conviction that these things are greater than they are. So it's a kind of intoxication. It's a drunkenness in the negative sense that is not reality. It's a temptation into a world, into a life of unreality. And indeed, chapter 16 is one of the more vivid and delightful stories, that this unreality can become a kind of fantasy of having responsibility over others. And it's the story of an Abba, of an elder, and Cassian says that he was staying in Skeet and he heard this story from the elder himself, who went to the cell of a certain brother to pay him a visit. And he heard he reached the door and heard the brother muttering and stood for a while wondering what beautifully edifying thing this brother could be doing. Is he reciting from the scriptures or is he meditating on a particular text? And it turned out instead that this person was kind of playing at Mass. He was in his cell acting as if he was celebrating the Eucharist and had reached that point after the sermon where he was dismissing the catechumens, which would have taken place after the homily. And so, in a sense, he's aggrandizing himself, imagining that he's in charge of this congregation and providing them with all these wonderfully stirring words. And so the elder then knocks at the door, and he meets the elder and brings him in and asks the elder if it was, you know, if he had if standing at the door for a long time was uncomfortable to him, and he jokingly replied, "Oh no, I only arrived while you were giving out the dismissal of the catechumens." In other words, the elder had heard what he was doing and understood perfectly what it was all about. Again, a kind of a delightful story intended to remind us of the kind of fantasy world that can be created in the heart and of which vainglory consists. Then in number 17, the reminder that one needs the cure, one needs to understand what to apply. Chapter 18, one of his suggestions, and this is absolutely classic, in fact, Cassian is quoted throughout the ages as a result of saying this, and it's not, he claims that he's not original with him, but of course, his is the Latin text by which it most frequently comes to be known in the West, but indeed it is found elsewhere in the Apothegmata as well. And he says, therefore, it is a maxim among us that that one should avoid women and bishops, and flee from women and bishops because of the danger of a committed loving relationship on the one hand, or of being made a priest, of being given this responsibility or this opportunity for self-aggrandizement and glory, glorification, self-glorification, that would be utterly wrong and simply be an example of vainglory. So he quotes this this old maxim from the desert in order to remind people of their need to remain faithful in making the kind of slow but steady progress within their monastic cells that God is causing them to do. And he recommends specific remedies in chapter 19. None of them particularly striking. He gives a verse from the scriptures in number 1. And again, this is chapter 19, and I've artificially numbered his recommendations 1 through 4. Thinking of David's text, "The Lord has scattered the bones of those who please men." Now, that's what vainglory consists in, trying to discover one's delight in how others delight in oneself. He says we should not do anything at the suggestion of vanity in number 2. Number 3, continue. Once you start something, continue doing it. Don't stop. Don't flit from one thing to the other, lest all of our efforts just kind of fade away and be, as he puts it, vain. And then finally, don't spend time with things that are not of value to the common life of the brethren. Engage in the activities and in the pursuits that are going to facilitate this ongoing inner relationship with others, the sense of our interdependence with one another, and that will supply a kind of antidote or a corrective to the tendency to misuse relationship in a way that sees the other as this mirror for self-glorification.